Moving. Don't have time to backtrack. We're on Genesis chapter 27. Remember, we're taking a trip through the Bible. We closed last week with Isaac and Rebekah giving birth to twin boys. And you remember the second boy was named because of the action that he took as an infant when he was born, grabbing, clutching the heel of his big brother. And so they named him Yaakov. A J in Hebrew is a Y, and a B is a V sound. Yaakov, Jacob, which means heel grabber, and then came to have a more metaphorical meaning of being a deceiver or con man that would sneak up behind you, see, and grab you. And remember, he lived up to that on two separate occasions. First, the birthright, and then the family blessing, both of which were to be bestowed upon the firstborn male in the family. Swindled his brother out of those. On the second occasion, his brother was so upset that he entertained murderous thoughts. And his mother found out about it, went to Jacob, said, "You need to hightail it out of here a few days till his fury subsides, and then you can come home." So he takes his mother's advice. She says, "Go up and live temporarily with my kinfolk." So off he went, traveling in that direction. And you remember he arrived in the vicinity of where these relatives lived, and he arrived at what we might call a central social site. It was a watering hole where people would come and retrieve their water and also water their livestock. And so he struck up a conversation with one of the locals. "You know the family of so-and-so?" And the fellow said, "Yeah, I know that family. In fact, there comes his daughter right there." And Jacob looked at that girl, and he must have instantly fell head over heels in love with her. And when she arrived on the scene, you remember they sat down and had a conversation. Before that conversation was over, he kissed her. And she ran home to her father, and he actually wept on that occasion, and then followed her and met his future father-in-law, and who welcomed him in with open arms. And so he was there about 2 months, and was very willing to help out around the estate and offer his assistance. And you remember the father-in-law said, "Look, just because you're kinfolk, no reason why you shouldn't be compensated for all of your work efforts. What would you like for me to pay you? What would you like your wages to be?" And he said, "I want to marry your daughter." And you remember Laban agreed, "If you work for 7 years." My wife and I have three daughters and one son. And I've always thought back there when they were making their marital decisions that we should go back to the Bible. I mean, look how many years of labor I would have gotten for that. But alas, not going to happen. Didn't happen. Do you remember he was so in love with that woman that the Bible says those 7 years seemed like a few days? And yet, at the end of that period, on his wedding night, you remember, he had done to him what he had done to others. He was conned and deceived. And his father-in-law tried to pass a different woman off, a sister. And to show you that Jacob did not entertain the notion of polygamy, he refused and told his father-in-law, "No deal." And his father-in-law said, "If you do not take the older sister, you don't get her." And so for that reason, he agreed. Well, do you remember over the next, 20 years? He so conducted himself and God was with him. In fact, there were a number of times where God intervened into this young man's life. You know, none of us come out of the womb righteous, let alone prepared to go to heaven. That doesn't happen. All of us are the product of many events in our lives, many circumstances, and how we choose to deal with those circumstances and all of our struggles. We have to grow spiritually. And you see throughout these chapters that very thing happening to Jacob. So God blesses him, and you remember he is so well blessed, even though his father-in-law didn't treat him right. Multiple times the father-in-law changed the agreement that they had made, and yet God blessed him through all of that. And finally, you remember Jacob had his fill of that and said, "I'm out of here. Enough of this." And so he loaded up family and children and his all of his belongings, and he just left without even telling his father-in-law, who, when he discovered their departure, set out in hot pursuit. And you remember when he overtook their caravan, he was upset and basically said to Jacob, "Why did you leave without letting me kiss my kids and grandkids goodbye?" And they patched up their differences, and Laban was content for their departure, and so he went back home. And you remember Jacob then turns his attention to returning to his home. And you remember what the circumstances were when he left. Even though it had been 20 years, his brother was mad enough to kill him. Do you know it's clear, though the Bible doesn't explicitly say so, that's what occupied his thoughts. Because look what he did. As they were approaching his homeland, you remember that he divided his entire retinue, his entire estate, into two bodies. He literally separated into two groups. Because you see, he's thinking, if Esau's still hostile and he attacks, maybe I can get away with at least half of my belongings. And do you remember that he positioned his family across a creek, a kind of a river, another natural land barrier to make it more difficult for Esau to inflict damage on his family? And then look at the way he arranges his family. Isn't the Bible incredible? Coming out of the mind of God and what God has chosen to record for us, preserve for us in history, these are real events. Unlike, you know, Harry Potter and all the other things that excite people about, that come out of the vivid imaginations of people. All of that's fake. None of it's real. But this is real. Do you remember that he placed the handmaidens with their children out front? And then he positioned Leah with her kids next. And then he put Rachel with her two children at the back of the pack. You see, the Bible doesn't try to hide people's biases, their prejudices, their attitudes about things. Well, do you remember the night before he is to encounter his brother, he has another encounter with God, which is also spiritually transforming in that boy's life. The next day, then, it came time for him to meet his brother. Now, he arranged for little groups to go out ahead of the family. Each one of these consisted of various gifts, like livestock and the like. And they each had a servant, and he told each one of them to make the same speech when they encounter his brother. And the gist of it was, these are gifts for my lord Esau from your slave Jacob. So all of this intended, no doubt, to soften up his brother, hoping that his brother's not still upset with him. So each of those bands of gifts or groups went out ahead. Well, when the time came for Esau to appear, here he came. And he had with him 400 men. And do you remember when he caught sight of his little brother? He ran at him. Now, if you were Jacob, given what's happened in the background, what would be your reaction? I envision him standing there, tense and wincing, expecting the worst. And when his brother arrived, he threw his arms around him and hugged him and kissed him. And then he said, "What was all this stuff you sent out in front?" And he makes the same speech. "Well, these are gifts for my lord Esau." He said, "I don't need that stuff. I've got plenty. I've prospered well. So you keep all of that." But don't you think Jacob was feeling guilty for what he had done? So he insisted that Esau take all of these things that he sent ahead. He finally agreed to take it. He then turned his group around and headed back. And Jacob took his time because he not only had lots of livestock, he was moving his entire estate, essentially, and all of these smaller children. Well, do you remember, as we move to the rest of the book of Genesis, moving to, let's say, chapter 37. Now the Bible, for the final chapters of Genesis, directs our attention essentially to the next generation of these patriarchs. Remember what we learned last week when human beings sinned. God began to unfold the scheme of redemption that he had planned in his own mind back in eternity, before he ever created human beings, let alone the universe. And so these individuals, beginning with Abraham, are key individuals in carrying out this ultimate purpose to provide for the salvation of humans. And that, of course, is Jesus. So all of these are predecessors to that. And so even though God is treating us to a lot of the details in their lives, from which we can learn so much about ourselves and people and how we are to ourselves mature spiritually, we're still constantly being reminded, little foreshadowing, that this is all simply steps to an ultimate goal. And that really becomes clear in these final chapters, because Jacob ends up having 12 sons and one daughter. And we're introduced to one of these boys beginning in chapter 37. He's a teenager when we meet him, 17 years old. And he is the apple of his father's eye. I mean, his father, you know, it's not right, really. It's not right for parents to manifest partiality toward their children, show favoritism to one child over another. It's really damaging to those children that feel that they are less favored. Now, children can sometimes imagine that their parents are showing favoritism when they're not. Probably many of us have experienced that. But he did. He made no bones about it. Even gave the boy special gifts that he didn't give the other boys, like that multicolored tunic. And so that created a hostility among the brothers toward this little brother. And then all of that was worsened by the fact that God allowed Joseph to have dreams. And you remember he had those dreams that apparently put the brothers, even the father, into a subservient position. Now that really sat well with the brothers, right? Now that was that not dumb for a brother to tell them, hey, guess what? You know, one of these days, you know what's going to happen? Well, that only engendered more jealousy, more hostility, more animosity. You know, Joseph was born to Jacob when Jacob was getting up in years. The older we get, the more our hearts seem to soften toward young people, and especially our own youth, our very young children. So all of that together created a very unhealthy family climate. That set the stage then for this series of events, like dominoes. The brothers, 10 of them, were out on family business, a good distance from home, probably about 50 miles. And Jacob becomes concerned about their whereabouts and their safety. So, no doubt against his better judgment, he sends this favored son out in search of his brothers to check on their well-being. And he's sporting this tunic that his father has given him. You remember he arrives at Shechem, is the general vicinity where some very, very nasty business had occurred we didn't talk about previously. And this local townsperson sees this teenage boy wandering around out in the open field looking lost. And so he goes over to him and says, what are you looking for? And he said, I'm looking for my brothers. And he said, well, they were here. But I overheard one of them say that they were going on to Dothan. That's another 10 or 12 miles further away from home. So off he goes in search of those brothers. Do you remember they see him coming in the distance? And they begin to talk amongst themselves. One of them says, behold, here comes the dreamer, referring to the dreams that he had had about them. Let's kill him, and we'll see what becomes of his dreams. But the oldest of the bunch, Reuben, spoke up in defense of his little brother and said, guys, let's not kill our own brother. Instead, let's put him in this cistern, a dry well. You know, the implication being, you know, he'll die of natural causes. We won't be responsible for directly shedding his blood. But the Bible says that what was in Reuben's mind was, it was his intention to just temporarily hold the brothers off where he could then sneak around later, retrieve the brother, and take him safely back home. So the brother arrives, Joseph arrives in their midst with cruel, rough hands. They mistreat him, strip him of that tunic, throw him into the pit, as Reuben, their oldest brother, suggested. And then they sat down to have a meal. And as they're eating, off in the distance comes a trade caravan from the north, headed to the south toward Egypt. Those trade caravans in that part of the world dealt in a number of commercial articles, including human flesh, slavery. So one of the brothers says, hey, let's sell him. You know, that way we'll be rid of him and yet make money. So when the caravan arrives, they pull their little brother up out of the pit, sell him for 20 paltry pieces of silver. That's a very low sum for a human in that day. And off he goes in custody with the caravan traveling southward toward Egypt. You know, the Bible doesn't tell us where Reuben was when that transaction was made, but he was out of pocket. When he came back and looked in the cistern and saw that his brother was gone, he tore his clothes, so typical of Oriental grief, and said, the boy is gone, and where shall I go? The brothers decide to concoct a story to tell their dad. So they take that tunic, they tear it, kill one of their animals, put animal blood on it, take it home, lay it down in front of their dad, ask him to make the identification, which he does. And I'm telling you that that man, he was getting up a few, you know, up in years, even at that point. It devastated him. He went into a period of mourning that was so prolonged and so intense that it endangered his life. You ever known anybody who lost a child and it so traumatized them that it began to affect their health? Boy, it did him. And his sons gathered around him and tried to comfort him, but he was not being comforted. It so affected him in the loss of that child. Well, meanwhile, Joseph was taken by this caravan down into Egypt. You know, I wonder how many days it took for them to get from the cistern all the way down to Egypt. And what was going on in his mind? You know, each night when they would arrive and set up a campfire or whatever, do you suppose he sat there and kind of strained to listen out through the darkness, thinking, you know, as soon as my dad finds out what these guys have done to me, he'll come and rescue me. You know, at some point, he had to have given up because dad didn't come. And when they arrived in Egypt, he was placed on the auction block and sold into the home of one of Pharaoh's court officials, a very high-ranking individual in Egyptian government. Remember, his name was Potiphar. And interestingly enough, a term is used in the Hebrew, translated officer in our versions, King James at least. And that's actually the normal Hebrew word for a eunuch. Now, Americans don't really know much about eunuchs. It's not really part of our culture. It's not part of our life. Not even probably part of our vocabulary. But this was very common in antiquity. Across a number of cultures, where individuals that aspired to some high position in the government, some high political post, especially if it brought you into contact with the royal family, you were required to give up your sexual ability. You were subjected to a surgical procedure and rendered sexually inactive. And that term is used to refer to Potiphar. I wonder if perhaps that doesn't help us to understand better the conduct of his wife. You know, Joseph so conducted himself, which is an incredible feature in and of itself, after what he's been through. He so conducted himself that he gained the confidence of his master, who placed him in charge of the entire estate, everything, except his wife. And yet she repeatedly made sexual advances toward him. And every time he deflected it and did his best to get away from her. And you remember one day she caught him indoors alone and once again made advances toward him. This time he did what Paul told the Corinthians to do in 1 Corinthians 6, flee fornication. I mean, he literally turned tail and ran from her. And I guess she had been spurned once too often. She reached out and grabbed for him and caught his outer tunic. And I guess when he felt the tug, he just let it slip off. And he ran on outside with the rest of the servants and workers. And she retained that article of clothing and used it to bolster her concocted claim when her husband came home that evening that, in fact, Joseph had made advances toward her. And there was the evidence for that. And he believed his wife. Every indication, he believed her. and consequently had Joseph consigned to prison. And there you remember he, once again, did not let life overwhelm him, but maintained his spiritual stamina and so conducted himself that the prison warden placed him in charge of other prisoners. And this brought him into contact with a specific class of prisoners, those who had been in the former employ of Pharaoh himself, but because of some slight or infraction or insult had been consigned to prison by Pharaoh. And you remember one morning he came into the room and two of these fellows were sitting there. And listen to what Joseph, you know, now here's a man who has every reason to think life is not fair. Woe is me. That was not his attitude. He really has a Christian attitude. He's thinking about other people, what's their condition, what needs do they have. That's agape. That's that selfless love that the New Testament speaks about. So he one morning he said, "Fellas, y'all looking kind of gloomy. What's the matter? What's going on?" And you remember one of them speaks up. This was the butler in our older translations, cupbearer in the newer translations. This was a person in ancient times who was responsible for screening the liquids that the monarch would drink. Very highly trusted post. And he said, "Well, I've had a dream. And it's causing me a lot of grief." And Joseph, now once again, look at the spirituality of this young man. He in essence says, you know, well, God has enabled me to interpret dreams. And so, tell me what you dreamed. And he related the details. And you remember Joseph said, well, you know, your dream means that in 3 days, you're going to be reinstated in your courtly capacity before Pharaoh. And you remember what he said at that point? He said, you know when that happens, will you please remember me sitting down here in prison? I didn't do anything to deserve to be put here. Well, the baker sitting over there listening to that says, well, I've had a dream too. And he relates the details. Sadly, Joseph has to inform him, your dream means that in 3 days, you're going to suffer execution. And the terminology seems to imply some form of impalement. Well, within 3 days, those dreams came true. The baker was executed. The butler was reinstated before Pharaoh. And notice the statement that's made there. He promptly forgot about Joseph. And Joseph sat in prison 2 additional full years. Don't you think enough's enough? How much should you and I, if we're trying to follow God, how much should we be expected to endure before you start thinking, this isn't fair? But there's no indication that Joseph ever felt that way. At least we're not told that he ever entertained that attitude. I mean, come on, he had been yanked out of his childhood in his home. He had suffered from the mistreatment of his brothers, sold into slavery, falsely accused, thrown in prison, and now he's been there for a lengthy period of time, and he's got 2 more years. But he dealt with it. And it's so easy for us to think that whatever happens to us in life that's discouraging, that's unfair, unjust, it might even be catastrophic, to think that we are somehow justified in what? Becoming less spiritual? I've known people who experience some horrible calamity, you know, like the death of a child or a grandchild. What about, you know, backing out of your driveway and running over your own, you know, 2-year-old child? That's happened. Many such things have happened. And I've known members of the church who just could not, they couldn't handle it. They said, you know what? If that's who God is, I'm out of here. Walk away from the church and from their Christianity. No indication Joseph ever considered doing that. But you know, I suppose he would have sat there for much longer. But one day, Pharaoh himself had dreams. He began to summon out of his empire all those individuals that claimed to be able to deal in such matters. You know, we have those in the United States a lot more than we've ever had. There was a period of spiritualism, it was called, in the late 1800s. That's when Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the author of Sherlock Holmes, got deep into that. That's when Houdini lived. There was even a congressional committee meeting that had Houdini come in, and he testified, it's all a bunch of bunk. And he showed them how you can fake all the seances and tables lifting and the whole bit. And, you know, even though now our society has all these individuals, you know, psychics and palm readers, you know, every time you drive by one of those houses, you know, stop in and Sister Sarah will, you know, read your report. They're always dumps. You know, you would think people that have these abilities would improve their living condition. And you remember the psychic hotline? We had a period there where that was going on. You know, like what? Psychic vibrations can move over telephone lines or something. I think it's digital now anyways, isn't it? And, you know, somebody at the other end talks to you about, you know, the Bible is very, very clear on this. Very clear. A number of terms are used in both the Old Testament language and the New Testament language, translated different ways. A number of terms in our English versions, from enchanters to mediums and spiritualists and different things. One of those terms is used in Revelation 21:8, where we are told that, among other activities, all those who engage in this practice will spend their eternity in the lake that burns with fire and brimstone. There's God's view of that. That's his view of it, because you see, it represents an alternative religion. It implies that God has not given us what Peter said he has given us, all things that pertain to life and godliness. You don't need anything else. God's given you everything you need to get through this life in such a way that you can step into eternity in good shape. So when you say to God, you know, that's really not enough, I need some additional assistance, and so you go consult somebody that claims to be able to do that. Well, that's an insult to God. He takes it personal. It's not only a lack of faith, it's actually an insult to our God. Well, you would think Egypt at the height of its civilization, you know, from Egyptologists and archaeologists, you know, they were a highly advanced civilization. So you'd think somebody could have helped the Pharaoh, but they couldn't. And that's when that old cupbearer, that butler, said, oh, I have been remiss. There was a fellow in prison a couple of years ago. He interpreted my dreams. He interpreted the baker's dream. They came true. Pharaoh said, you get him out here. So they went to the prison system to retrieve Joseph. And to show you something of prison conditions in the Egyptian Empire, they had to clean him up, give him a shave, and put on new clothes. If you went to the prison today to retrieve somebody, you'd probably say, shut off your color TV and your air conditioner and come with me. Something like that. That's not the prisons of antiquity. Joseph endured probably what we would call a dungeon. Harsh conditions. They cleaned him up and stood him in front of that monarch, and that pagan pharaoh said, I understand you can help me. And once again, showing Joseph's perspective, if I might paraphrase, he said, well, you know, there's a God. Well, obviously, the Egyptians believed in many gods. They knew that. But Joseph was challenging that. In fact, what, five times in this little intercourse that he has with Pharaoh, he refers to God and makes it clear that really that's the only way this can be done. And he's empowered me to deal in these matters, so relate the dream. And you remember Pharaoh related the dream. It was kind of a two-part dream, one involving cows, some lean, some fat, and then the heads of grain. And Joseph said, well, you know, this is the same dream. God's giving it to you in two forms in order to stress the certainty with which these events are going to come to pass. Now, let me tell you what they mean. For the next 7 years, Egypt will experience unparalleled agricultural prosperity. I mean, the land will produce bountifully. But at the end of that seven-year period, another seven-year period will set in. This one will be one of deprivation, famine, hardship, calamity. In fact, it'll be so bad that people won't even remember the 7 years of plenty. Now, what you need to do is appoint a prime minister to take charge over the next 7 years of stockpiling all surplus produce and preparing, making necessary preparations to, in order to survive this great calamity that lies before us. And do you know that pagan foreign king said, well, who would be a better man for that job than this one in whom the Spirit of God resides? And so on that occasion, now think about this, he took this foreigner, a Hebrew, slave, convict, and promoted him to what was essentially the top political post of the Egyptian Empire, second only to Pharaoh himself, who did not relinquish his throne. And yet he was clearly turning the orchestration of the nation over to this individual. So much so that he placed a gold chain around his neck, dressed him in royal Egyptian regalia, gave him an Egyptian name, and then took off of his own hand the royal signet ring. That's the ring that in ancient times kings used to authenticate governmental decrees, to send them forth with all the authority of the throne. He took that off his hand, put it on Joseph's hand. It's incredible, simply incredible. If you want to know something of his, by the way, he's 30 years old. If you want to know something of his mental state, the Bible divulges it. During the 7-year period of plenty, he met and married an Egyptian girl. They had 2 sons born to their marriage. The day the first little boy was born, Joseph named him Manasseh. In Hebrew, that means one who causes to forget. Why would you name your child forgetting? Well, he tells us. Now, maybe I can forget. And he uses 2 terms. My toil, the King James says, that could have just as easily been translated my hardship, my stress, my tribulation, and God's enabling me to forget my father's house. Does that not tell us this boy has been haunted all these years by memories of dad and home and family? Prematurely ripped out of his childhood. Didn't even get to finish it. And it's affected him all these years. All the trauma that he's been through. So much so that he names his firstborn son Forgetting. Now maybe I can start to forget some of what I've been through. The second little boy, Ephraim. We say Ephraim. Means productive or fruitful. And the statement he makes on that occasion is, now God is allowing me to be fruitful. And then he says, in the land of my affliction. What? Joseph, you are the prime minister of the Egyptian Empire. You can go anywhere you want, do anything you want, have anything you want. You call this the land of your affliction? That's what he calls it. May I suggest to you, this young man was scarred. Physically, emotionally, psychologically. Maybe more than any of us ever have been or ever will be. And yet maintained his spirituality. Because you remember on that occasion when she made advances toward him, the statement that he made, chapter 39, verse 9. How could I commit this great wickedness and sin against God. Now that there's the glue that held him together through all of his adversities. That was it. He may not have had his dad anymore, his family looking over his shoulder, didn't have his culture, his home, even his language. But he still had God. See, that gives you stability no matter where you are on the planet, whatever you're going through at any moment in your life. There's the one thing that can give us the stamina and the strength to overcome sin and Satan and to survive spiritually. It's amazing. Well, you remember he carried out his governmental duties during that 7-year period in fine fashion. He mobilized the nation, stockpiled the necessary produce and preparations, and then the period of deprivation set in. And I'm telling you that famine was so severe that the Egyptian population cried out to Pharaoh for governmental relief. And Pharaoh said, "Go see the prime minister. He's the man in charge." Do you know the tentacles of that famine reached so far up from Egypt that it spread up into Palestine? And one day Jacob called all of his sons together and said, "Fellas, we're going to have to do something in order to survive this famine. I understand that there is sustenance in Egypt, so I need you to load up for this trip, take money with you, and go down there and purchase some supplies for us to get through this hard period." So in obedience to their father's command, they loaded up, took their provisions and their money. They traveled down into Egypt. They arrived at the governmental distribution facility. And they were ushered into the presence of the prime minister, their own brother, whom they do not recognize. Can you understand why? Well, not only was this the last person they expected to see in that position, in that place, but Joseph is now pushing 40 years of age. He's fully enculturated. For all practical purposes, he is an Egyptian. He looks like an Egyptian, walks like an Egyptian. He's dressed like an Egyptian, royal regalia. Yeah, I thought you'd like that. And by the way, he speaks fluent Egyptian. He still remembers Hebrew, but he speaks Egyptian. And by the way, only speaks to his brothers through an interpreter. Speaks Egyptian, who then translates into Hebrew. Now, the last time they saw their brother, he was a teenager. How much visual appearance change occurs from the time you're a teenager to the time you're middle-aged? Did you change much? You know, go back and look at that high school annual. And there'll be your name under somebody else's picture, it looks like. You know, we really undergo change. Have you been away from somebody for 20 years and then come upon them and thought, "Man, if I'd seen you on the street, I wouldn't have recognized you"? We change our look. So when they see this high government official, by the way, they bow down before him, fulfilling those dreams that he had spoken 20 years earlier. So they don't recognize him, but it is clear. In an instant, he recognizes them. And all those years of resentment that must have seethed in him came boiling up and out. And he said, "You are spies." And can you imagine their reaction? "What? No. Yes. You are spies. You are down here to examine our vulnerabilities." And I'm telling you, they start talking fast. "No, sir, we're all brothers. We're all the sons of one man. There were 12 of us. One of us is not." That was Joseph. "And one of us is still at home with our dad." I don't think there's any doubt that when they said that, suddenly Joseph's mind was flooded with memories of the identity of that younger brother. That was Benjamin. That was Joseph's only full-blooded brother. Do you remember how Benjamin came into this world? You know, Rachel had gone through several years of marriage, unable to have children. We mentioned how that tormented women in these Middle Eastern cultures back at this time. But finally, she gave birth to Joseph. And don't you know, when she became aware of the fact that she was expecting her next child, she must have been elated. The Bible says that they were out on a family trip, and they were caught in between towns. And of course, in those days, they didn't rely on hospitals and things like we do. Generally, midwives would travel with these caravans. And as they were traveling, the text says she went into labor. But look at how the inspired writer is very meticulous and specific, if we'll pay attention. In our English translations, it says that she went into hard labor. We would call that life-threatening labor. The kind of thing that many, many women in human history have died from. Died in childbirth. And even though the midwives gathered around her and tried to reassure her that she was going to be able to get through this, it was clear that she was dying. In fact, the Bible says, as her spirit was exiting her body. There's the biblical definition of death. Evolutionists, atheists, skeptics, they don't believe that we have anything other than what we are, just kind of a matter in motion. So when you die, you're dead. That's it. No, each one of us are simply housed in our fleshly bodies. But that's not who we are. Our bodies change and they'll turn to dust. They came from dust, they'll go to dust. But we won't. We're going to exist forever. So as her body was leaving, as her spirit was leaving her body, she was dying. She gave birth to a little baby boy, and with her dying breath, named him Ben-Oni. In Hebrew, that means son of my distress. And then she died. Now, don't you know that Jacob did not want that name to stick? Forever be reminded of the death of his most beloved wife, giving birth to their second child. So he changed the little boy's name from Ben-Oni to Ben-Yamin, Benjamin, which means son of my right hand. So when these brothers come down into Egypt and they tell Joseph, one of our brothers is still at home, that's who they're talking about. Benjamin would not have participated in the conspiracy that sold him into Egypt. He was too young at the time. So it's clear, is it not, that what he then almost instantaneously concocts in his mind, this great plan. I want to see my little brother after all these years. He didn't do anything to harm me. And so here's what he says. He says, you know, in order for me to verify your story, your claim that there's nothing going on here, I'm going to throw all of you into prison, but I'll let one of you go back and retrieve this alleged brother you claim to have. Bring him down here so we can verify your story. And after he says that, he throws them all into prison. He waits a little while, 2-3 days, and then brings them back out. He says, I tell you what, I fear God. I'll let all of you but one go back home. Take the provisions you came for so you can take care of your households. But I'm going to hold one of you hostage. That's when the boys began talking, the men began talking amongst themselves, unaware that Joseph can understand what they're saying. Here's what they say. We are very guilty concerning our brother. Talking about Joseph. The King James says, we saw the anguish of his spirit when he besought us. Look at that picture. Now, we didn't get this picture back earlier when he was sold into slavery. And now we're getting a little more information. And here was the scene. The caravan shows up. The brothers say, let's sell him. They reach down with rough hands and pull him up out of there. And he realizes what they're going to do. And he begins begging them, pleading with them, This boy is traumatized. You can't do this to me. And they're owning up to that. And they said, we wouldn't listen to him. And that's when Reuben, the oldest, spoke up and said, didn't I tell you not to sin against that boy? Now his blood is being required of us. Isn't that something that after all those years and all the things that must have happened in their lives in the intervening years, now that they're in serious trouble, they pin it all on one event that occurred way back there. That's why this is happening to us. And you know, Joseph's listening to this and he begins to cry. He turns away where they can't see him. Why? Why did he start crying? Well, I think two things. One, he realizes these fellows are at least sorry at this point for what they did to him, so much so that they're blaming this current affliction on what they had done. They're showing signs of remorse. And then when he found out that they weren't all against him, Reuben had spoken up and tried to defend him and prevent what they were doing. Those revelations so overwhelmed him, he began to weep. He regained his composure, came back into their midst, gave orders not for the oldest, but the second oldest, to be taken into custody, bound, and placed into prison. Gave orders for the provisions to be given to the men for which they had come. They paid for the supplies with their money. But you remember Joseph gave orders to one of his government officials, his attendants, you take the money that they have spent here, and without them knowing about it, put that in their luggage along with the provisions they purchased. And then off they go with this admonition. Don't show your faces down here again unless you bring the alleged brother you claim to have. So off they go. They arrive at their first night's lodging. One of them happens to check the luggage and finds their money returned. And I mean, their hearts sank. They said, what is this that God is doing to us? When they arrived home, they gained an audience with their father. They said, Dad, you're not going to believe what's happened. There was a high-ranking government official down there that accused us of espionage. He threw Simeon in prison and said that in order for us to verify our story, we're going to have to go back home, retrieve Benjamin, and take him back down there in order to show him that we were telling the truth. And Jacob, if I might update the terminology, said, no way, Jose. You're not taking that boy back to Egypt. I've already lost Joseph. Now I've lost Simeon, and I'm not giving up the last child of Rachel. They said, Dad, we don't have any choice here. We've got to take him down there to verify our story. And Reuben spoke up and said, Dad, if you'll entrust the safety of the boy to me, and I fail to get him back here, you can kill my two boys. I'm not sure why Reuben thought that Jacob would want to kill two of his grandchildren, now that I have grandchildren. You know, grandchildren are what God gives you for not killing your own children. Any of you that have been through this, you understand completely. But boy, doesn't that tell us something about Reuben? Man, what a sacrificial, giving person. Well, Jacob's having none of it. So they finally just give up, going about their business, and some time goes by, and he calls them back together. Fellas, we're getting low on provisions. You're going to have to go back to Egypt and get us enough food to survive this period. And they said, Dad, we're not going unless you let us take Benjamin back. And you know, at that point he said, a typical father, why did you tell that man that you had a brother back here? Did your mother ever say anything to you like, you talk too much? You didn't have to tell people that. Why don't you keep your mouth shut? That sort of thing. That's what he was saying. And you know what their reaction was? How were we to know if we told him we had a brother, he'd say, go get him. We were just trying to verify that we were telling the truth. This time, Judah speaks up. Says, Dad, if you will entrust the safety of the lad to me, promise you I'll get him back to you, and if not, you can hold it against me the rest of my life. Do you see these are changed men? Well, Jacob's attitude is, if we don't have provisions, we're going to die. So you're going to have to go on back. You know, so be it. And if I lose another son, if I lose Benjamin, then I'll go to my grave. That'll do it for me. So very hurriedly, they load up provisions for the trip. They take money to purchase more provisions and the money that had been returned to them on the previous trip. They hurried back down to Egypt. They arrive at the governmental distribution facility. But this time they receive most disconcerting instructions. You are to proceed to the private residence of the prime minister. Now that kind of shook them up. They thought, this is fishy. They thought either we're about to be attacked or captured, imprisoned, who knows what. Something's going on here. But they followed the instructions. And you remember when they encountered Joseph's head steward, they kind of pulled him aside and said, look, the last time we were here, we paid for the provisions that we purchased, but when we got out of town, our money had been returned to us, but we want to assure you, we paid. And you know, obviously that was a circumstance where Joseph was testing them. These were the greedy men who sold him for 20 pieces of silver. So they passed that test. Steward said, we got your money. Your God must be blessing you. You remember Joseph came home, probably, I'm guessing, at the noon hour from his governmental duties, walks into the presence of those brothers, and they all bow down before him. And then he sees Benjamin. Is this the brother of whom you spoke? This is him. He choked out a few words, the equivalent of, you know, may God bless you, young man. And then he turned away, left the room, and wept like a baby. So moved at the sight of this little brother after all these years. Having regained his composure, he came back into their midst, gave orders for them all to be seated, gave orders for them to be fed a meal, gave private orders for five times as much food to be heaped onto the plate of Benjamin as all the other brothers. Simeon brought out of custody to participate in the meal. When they had completed the meal, they were allowed to purchase the provisions for which they had come. But once again, Joseph turned to his steward and said, you take my silver chalice and you hide it in the luggage of the youngest of the men. Send them on their way. All of those orders were kept. The fellows gathered up. They got on their beasts of burden. They headed out of town. And don't you know, when they got out of the outskirts, they thought, we made it. But Joseph gave orders to his steward to set out in hot pursuit. When you overtake their caravan, make this speech. How dare you mistreat my master when he's been so good to you as to steal from him? Then you implement a search. When you find my silver chalice, you take that individual into custody, bring him back to me, tell the rest of them, go home. You see the plan here? So they head out, they overtake the caravan. How dare you mistreat me? We haven't done anything. Go ahead, search our luggage. That was before Miranda rights and all that. And so they began a search. They start at the oldest, and they work down through the luggage, and they come to that youngest. Horror of horrors, there is the silver chalice. Don't you know those brothers' hearts sank? They take him into custody. They tell them, move on. We don't want you here. Now you think they're going to go home and face their dad? They can't. So they follow this fellow back into town. That brings them back into the presence of Joseph. He didn't want to see him anymore, so he keeps up the charade. Why did you steal from me after I've been so good? Well, they hadn't stolen from him. That was all part of his ruse to get Benjamin down there with him. You know, one of the brothers stepped up and said, sir, please, please don't be angry with us. You need to hear some things. I need to explain some things. We had another brother that we lost, and it nearly killed our dad. I think when they said that, Joseph's heart must have instantly softened. Notice he hadn't given any indication that he was concerned about his father until they arrived at this last time and he said, "How's your dad? Is he still alive and well?"
Yeah.
He must have felt some resentment that dad never came and rescued him. He was a wealthy man and not that far away from Egypt. He never came. Now he knows why. His dad thought he was dead. That must have been a new insight right there. You remember when he hears all of this and sees these young men, these men who are changed men, he can stand it no longer. He bursts out crying right in front of them. He gives orders for the room to be cleared of all the Egyptian personnel. He then turns to his brothers. And can you imagine what they're thinking? Here's a high-ranking Egyptian official having apparently a nervous breakdown right in front of us. What is going on here? And he turns to his brothers and he says, "Fellas, it's me, Joseph, your brother." And it's clear from the text they don't believe him. And he repeats it to them. It must have taken some for that to sink in. They're standing there incredulous. And in chapter 45, he delivers a speech. Incredible speech. We've got to go back and read it frequently. A speech filled with faith in God, confidence in God's will, including his awareness that God had arranged things where those promises that they were familiar with, those boys were familiar with the promises that had been passed down from Jacob, prior to that Isaac, and prior to that Abraham. Promises from God that he was going to take care of them and see that they survived. And here these descendants that would be the forebears of this great nation that God promised they would have were in great danger. And so he said, I now can see, look how providence works. Works today too. I now see what's going on here. God arranged for me to be here in this place at this time so that I could rescue the whole family so I don't hold you responsible. Isn't that incredible after what he's been through? Well, the first thing he does is he goes over to Benjamin, throws his arms around him, hugs him, and those two men just stood there weeping. And then he went down the line and gave each one of his brothers a hug. And then the Bible says they sat down and had a good family talk. Wouldn't you like to have been a fly on the wall and listen to that? He said, I'm going to load you guys up. Go back home. Tell Dad I'm alive. Tell him I want everybody to move down here to Egypt. I'm going to take care of everybody. And so they do so. They go back. And can you just see this? You know, they throw the screen door open. Dad, guess what? Joseph's alive. And he is the prime minister of the Egyptian Empire. And so again, you know, Jacob's reaction, yeah, right. He doesn't believe him. Mm-mm. You're telling me that this son, for whom I have mourned for more than two decades, whom I've been convinced is dead, is alive, and he's been elevated to the Egyptian Empire in a high governmental capacity? That's hard to believe. But they finally convince him. And they load up the entire family and estate. By this time, kids, grandkids, grandchildren, there's over 70 people. Pharaoh provides what we would call moving vans. He deeds prime real estate. You want to know a little bit about immigration? They didn't just storm into Egypt. They were literally invited by the Pharaoh, who deeded prime real estate to them in Goshen. The Bible says that. And you remember they arrived and got settled, and Joseph was allowed a very, very few, no doubt, short years with his father. And the day came where Jacob died. And at the funeral, Joseph threw himself down on the body of his father and wept. You know, he must have been trying to kind of, what, recapture his lost childhood in those waning years. But you can't do that, can you? When it's gone, it's gone. The funeral was carried out according to Egyptian custom. The body was mummified. A typical Egyptian funeral would last 30 or 40 days. They received Joseph received permission from Pharaoh to transport the body back to Palestine to be buried in the family tomb. When the family had come back and resettled in Egypt, the brothers got together and said, "Now we're going to get it. Joseph's going to take vengeance on us." So they put together kind of a brotherly delegation, sought an audience with their famous brother. They came into his presence and said, "Joseph, before Dad died, he told us that he wanted us to come to you after his death and to ask you in his name to please forgive us for what we did to you." And you know, that hurt Joseph's feelings. He began to cry. This is in chapter 50. He said, "Fellas, I told you that I don't hold you responsible. I believe God was orchestrating this. Oh, you meant to harm me, but God meant it for good. So I don't hold you responsible, and I told you I'm going to take care of you and your little ones." The Bible says he comforted his brothers with those words. Joseph himself passed from this life at the age of 110. He too, his body, was buried according to Egyptian funeral technology, mummification. But you know, he left this provision in his will. He said, "The day is coming," another indication of the spiritual orientation of this man, "the day is coming when God's going to fulfill his promises that he made to our forefathers. When that day comes, I want my body down here in Egypt disinterred and transported to the promised land, and there reinterred." Isn't that incredible? We have 65 books of the Bible to complete. So I hope you'll be here next week and we'll take another stab at it. But we got through Genesis. God is good. He's so kind to us. Let's bow and pray.